Now, one of the scientists at the centre of the row over leaked emails between climate change scientists has spoken out tonight for the first time. Professor Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Centre at Pennsylvania State University, was the recipient of several of the emails, including some from Professor Phil Jones, who has now temporarily stood down as director of the Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Professor Mann says he in no way endorses some of what was said in the emails he received, that he can't justify a request that he delete some of his own emails, and that Professor Jones made some poor decisions. Well, climate change sceptics have argued that the emails indicate that some scientists were deliberately massaging climate change research data to strengthen their case that human activity is contributing to a dangerous rise in average temperatures. When I spoke to Professor Mann this evening, I started by asking if he accepts that the emails that have been leaked are genuine.
Yes, the stolen emails do look to be genuine, at least the ones involving my name.
Let me then ask you about a couple of them specifically. One from Phil Jones back in 2004, which has been quoted, in which he said to you, "I can't see either of these papers being in the next IPCC report. Kevin and I will keep them out somehow, even if we have to redefine what the peer review literature is." What do you understand that to be about?
Well, of course, that was an email sent to me, and in no way reflects my views on the matter. As I understand it, the two papers that were being talked about were dealing with the instrumental surface temperature record.
Do you understand why people outside, when they see somebody talking about redefining what peer review literature is, come to the conclusion that somebody's trying to change the definitions in such a way as to favor their own interpretation of data?
Well, again, I can't put myself in the mind of the person who wrote that email and sent it. I in no way endorse what was said in that email.
Okay, let's take another one also from Phil Jones to you. This one's dated May of 2008, in which he said to you, "Can you delete any emails you may have had with Keith re-AR4? Keith will do likewise." What is AR4?
AR4 is the fourth assessment report of the IPCC. I did not do what was requested.
You didn't delete those emails?
No, I didn't.
Do you know why Phil Jones wanted you to?
I think that he was feeling hounded by attackers who were basically preventing him from doing his work by constantly trying to issue Freedom of Information Act requests. My understanding is that at our period of time, something like 50 Freedom of Information Act requests were submitted to the University of East Anglia.
Okay, but when he was talking about deleting emails, he clearly was asking you to get rid of information which he did not want somebody, for whatever reason, to have access to.
Yeah, again, I can't justify the action. I can only speculate that he was feeling so under attack that he made some poor decisions, frankly, and I think that's clear.
You have seen what people have said since these emails emerged. Those who are skeptical about the degree of climate change which is underway take these emails as a vindication of their view that some scientists, perhaps including yourself and those with whom you've been in contact, have been massaging the data. Now, that is hugely damaging to the case that you've been trying to make, isn't it?
Yeah, there's absolutely no evidence at all in any of these emails that I have in any way massaged data or manipulated data. So those
what about your colleagues?
I can only speak for myself here. I don't believe that any of my colleagues have done that. I don't see anything in these emails that implies that they have. Now, what's important to understand here is that we're going into this very important meeting in Copenhagen. There is a consensus among the world scientists that climate change is real and there's a need to confront it. Those who are advocating inaction, who don't want to see progress made in Copenhagen, don't have the science on their side. So instead, they've manufactured this false controversy to distract the public and to distract policymakers to try to thwart progress next week in Copenhagen.
Well, with respect, they haven't manufactured the emails, have you? You've accepted that, as far as you can see, these emails are genuine.
The emails are genuine and have been misrepresented, cherry-picked, mined for single words and phrases that can be completely twisted to imply the opposite of what it was actually being said. It's a manufactured controversy, and the timing of it is not coincidental, as far as I'm concerned.
Professor Michael Mann of Pennsylvania State University. Well, we did ask the University of East Anglia if Professor Jones wanted to respond to Professor Mann's comments. We were told there was nothing he wished to say. The row over these leaked emails is far from the first time that scientists have been accused of massaging evidence to fit a theory. But there does seem to be a growing public mistrust of what scientists tell us, particularly if their findings could impinge on our daily lives. Paul Moss reports.
It was a lively conversation. The group gathered in a South London flat all use science in their day-to-day lives. Two work in healthcare, one is studying for a master's degree. But all of them are sceptical about the claims that science makes.
Generally speaking,
so the science, the pure science of it, sometimes doesn't.
Lucy and Susan insist they're not anti-science, but what they won't accept is that science provides us with some kind of unadulterated truth.
I suppose I see science as more of a guideline or a lens that you might get information through that you can make decisions based upon, but I wouldn't say it as being 100% of the whole truth. There are some friendly scientists and some not-so-friendly scientists, and it very much depends who's giving me the information, whether or not I feel to be, in inverted commas, true.
How about you, Lucy? Do you see science as truth?
I don't believe that science is particularly the objective truth. What I know about is that the people who commission scientific research projects, they have specific findings in mind. They want a piece of research to prove that they're heading in the right direction.
That is precisely what's been suggested about some of the climate scientists at East Anglia University. The allegation is that they set out to prove the reality of global warming, so that they highlighted experiments which supported the theory and tried to suppress evidence which contradicted it. But some scientists argue that this is in fact a field where prejudice and politics have long held sway.
I think what we want to try and do is to capture. We pitched the idea to you that
I caught up with Professor Martin Parry at a conference to discuss the effects of climate change. He's one of the world's leading experts in this field and takes a dim view of those who don't believe in global warming. The problem, he argues, is that climate change deniers see science as a matter of opinion rather than a matter of fact.
There has been a tendency for the conclusions of science somehow to be taken almost as a belief which you pick up or you don't. When people see such huge changes that have to be made to the way we live, if we're going to sustain our way of life on this planet, maybe it's easier to deny the science, deny the challenge. People begin to identify themselves as believers in the science of climate change or disbelievers in the science. It's not debate about science.
We're giving girls aged 12 up to 18 the HPV vaccine against cervical cancer.
If climate change is a controversial scientific field, then one area of medicine has perhaps raised passions even more. Vaccines have long been the subject of scares, whether preventing whooping cough or measles. And this year, the introduction of the HPV vaccine against cervical cancer prompted another pandemic of panic, with fears about what the side effects of the vaccine might be.
Arm your daughter against cervical cancer. Visit NHS.
One teenage girl did die shortly after having the vaccine. Doctors insisted she had other health problems, but that didn't stop lurid tabloid stories warning about the dangers. Dr. Anne Sharevsky worked on the introduction of the cervical cancer vaccine, and she argues that people with a moral agenda have sown distrust in what scientists tell us.
We've known for well over 100 years that cervical cancer is related to sexual activity. So the people who are against the HPV vaccine, they feel that it's a license for promiscuity. They don't want to just come straight out and say this is actually a moral argument. And so they kind of use bits of science that have maybe applied to other vaccines, maybe a long time ago. They're playing on this for their own ends.
If the public have an appetite for this kind of stuff, what do you think that says about how the public see science?
I think that the public has for many, many, many years had an ambivalent attitude to science. And perhaps the scientists themselves have contributed to that by perhaps always sounding too sure, so that then when there's anything slightly wrong with what they said, it looks like they made a complete mistake.
Modern-day science is a product of the Enlightenment era. With its rigorously empirical approach, it offered truth and certainty in a world where so much else was unsure. Moral and aesthetic judgments were a matter of opinion. Religion demanded unreasoning faith. Science, by contrast, was seen as having solid foundations. But there are critics who think all this early adulation has gone to scientists' heads. The philosopher Jonathan Ray argues they will never quite deserve the privileged position they would like to claim.
I do get a bit fed up with scientists when they get all kind of defensive and prim about the sacred purity of their discipline. With a foolproof kind of recipe for discovering the truth, the procedures of actual science are much more chaotic and conflicted, and scientific congresses can be just about as unedifying as prime minister's questions. I mean, they're always getting at each other. And I mean, the essence of science is disagreement, not agreement, and even scientists are only human.
The government's drug czar claimed cannabis and ecstasy were less dangerous than alcohol and cigarettes. Now he's been sacked.
The question of science and its status was brought into sharp focus recently when Professor David Nutt was fired from his job. He advised the government on drugs, but the Home Secretary decided Professor Nutt was wrong in his beliefs and had expressed them inappropriately. Other scientists, Alan Johnston said, had other views. But Professor Nutt remains unrepentant. He insists that when it comes to science, there is no debate to be had. If a small minority hold dissenting views, they should be rejected, not indulged.
Science can never be a democratic process. If you're applying the appropriate form of interrogation of data, you will come up with an answer which will be an accepted fact. You won't be able to debate it. The scientific evidence overwhelmingly points to ecstasy not being a Class A drug. The scientific evidence overwhelmingly points to global warming occurring. That is the fact. Those are the facts.
Well, that was the former chairman of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, Professor David Nutt, ending that report by Paul Moss. With me now here in the studio is the environment correspondent of New Scientist magazine, Katrine Brahek. You hear somebody like Professor Nutt saying, these are the facts, and members of the public are bound to take the view that scientists know for sure what is fact and what is not. Are they right to trust what scientists tell them?
Yes, I think they are, and I don't actually think that there is a sort of disintegration in the public trust in science recently. I haven't seen any evidence for that. But I'd also agree with one of the contributors. I think she was a PhD student or a postdoc in that piece, who said that that science isn't actually about the ultimate truth. There is no such thing as the ultimate truth, and science has always been and will always be about debate. And that, in fact, is exactly what those climate emails revealed. By and large, what you saw was a lot of climate scientists debating facts and debating disagreement.
And therein lies the problem, because, of course, politicians and, by extension, voters are expected to make decisions based on what scientists tell them, even while the scientists are continuing to debate.
Yes, this is true, and there is a bit of an uneasy situation there where we rely on science to structure our society, but science is not absolute.
It's not unchanging either, is it?
No, it's ever-changing. It's absolutely ever-changing. That's the beauty of science, and I don't think you'd find many scientists who would disagree with that, to be honest.
But you do hear scientists in the climate change debate saying, oh, but the overwhelming consensus within the scientific community is that human activity plays a significant role in climate change. But overwhelming consensuses, if that's the plural, don't necessarily stand the test of time, do they? Once the overwhelming consensus was that the Earth was flat.
This is true, but we can only go with the overwhelming consensus that we've got at the moment. And I think in that case, it's actually climate scientists being extremely cautious, because in the past, a lot of times people have shown that some science has actually been wrong. So some evidence has been shown to be faulty. And they're very wary of that. But if you look at the facts, if you look at the evidence, there is absolutely no question that the big message here is completely unchanged, that humans are causing climate change.
Do you think scientists sometimes feel that they are under pressure, both from politicians and from the public to express things with more certainty than perhaps they would be comfortable with?
Yes, I think they absolutely are. And I think as a society, we need to decide what we want from our scientists. I mean, I've spoken to many climate scientists who are very uncomfortable taking a political stance because they feel like they are being pressured into that. But at the same time, they have to recognise that they have the evidence, that they have to offer that up to society. But equally, we need to decide in what instances we want them to be individuals and in what instances we want them to be objective scientists.
Katrine Brahek from New Scientist, thanks very much. Thank you. You're listening to The World Tonight on Radio 4 with Robin Lustig. In a moment...